You're listening to The Zesty Garden, and in with me this week is Shane Taylor, horticultural specialist and buyer for cactus and tropicals in Salt Lake. And we're looking at different houseplants that he recommends for you to buy for various reasons and to have in your own home. And this one is a Gymnocalycium, and I would have no idea what that is if I hadn't looked at an image of it. So why don't you describe this family of plants?
Well, this is a type of cactus. This is a true cactus, and it's really tricky. How do you pick one type of cactus? I love cactus. I think they're really neat. But a good one in general, Gymnocalycium, is excellent because it's a pretty strong bloomer, and several of its varieties have either small spines or no spines. So they're good for environments where you might have kids or pets and you worry about them getting poked with those spines. And they come in so many different variations. They're nice little sort of like softball size cactus. And their flowers will often be as big or bigger than the plant itself when they bloom. And they'll bloom pretty much annually. Mine will set bud this time of year and come up with some bright pink flowers. And it's just always fun to watch it bloom.
But the nice thing about it is that the cactus itself, not including the flowers, looks great year round. And so this is just an added bonus having the blossoms.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Gymnocalycium, they're so versatile and popular. You might see them around in different stores where they've actually altered them slightly by burning out the chlorophyll, and they're brightly colored. They're red or they're pink or they're yellow, and they're grafted on top of another cactus, usually a Salina cirrus. That's the green trunk that's doing the photosynthesis duty for both the plants. And it's amazing how hardy they are, the fact that they can live even without chlorophyll grafted onto another and do well. Their care is actually fairly simple as well. Like all the other plants I picked, this is one that you really don't have to give a whole lot of water to, although you do have to give it a lot of sun. And this is something that is going to thrive only in a direct sun window, so maybe 3 hours or more per day.
Okay. That makes sense, like any cactus.
Yeah.
It wants to have some sun.
Very slow growers. You'll see just minimal growth on the plant year to year, so good for small spaces. They're coloration can be wild and crazy, like the ones that have been irradiated, and they can be more subtle, like the natural ones that will be shades of blue green, kind of a purplish or sage green. And then the needles again can be a half an inch or so, all the way down to just almost nothing, depending on the variety.
And there are some, it looks like, that have they're more of a solid globe, where others almost look like they've got leaves on them.
Yeah, just some great variation within the genus. And cactus, you know, being one of those unique plant families that's only found in North and South America. There are no cactus native to any other part of the world. It's just such an amazing group of plants, and it's one of those that everybody should at least try a cactus at some point. And this is something that's a little bit more accessible, a little bit easier to deal with. And as long as you're letting it go completely dry between waterings, even to the point of sometimes a full month in between watering, and keeping it in a sunny window, there's really not much other care that you have to give it.
And what type of soil should it be in?
Oh, there are specific cactus soils that do really well with plants similar to this. It's just going to be a type of soil that's a lot more porous.
High drainage.
Yeah, high drainage. And very low nutrient. You don't want to put them in soil that has fertilizer mixed in already. Really, the only time of year that they're going to even want fertilizer is going to be in the springtime before their bloom. If you start seeing those little buds pop up on the top, you know it's time to give them their one yearly dose of bloom fertilizer to help them develop as healthy flowers as they possibly can. And that's it.
This is the Gymnocalycium. So when you go into a big box store, are you going to see this in there? It seems like I've seen them around, but if they don't, how do you know what to ask for if you can't remember that name?
That's a good question. You can say softball cactus. or just look for, you know, the little rounded half globes mixed in with their assortments. They're usually interesting enough that they get snatched up first. I've noticed that from our assortments, that every time we bring in a grouping of cactus, we'll get little old man cactus, we'll get the prickly pear cactus, and we'll get a few of these mixed in, and these will disappear first. But they're, I'm not sure what you'd call them other than Gymnocalycium, and often in big box stores, they're probably, you might be lucky, somebody might know what you're talking about if you ask them, but...
And like a lot of cactus, that when they do flower, they're just very colorful.
Very colorful. Usually colors of pink, hot pink, red, sometimes peach or white. Yeah, just great variety.
Well, our recommended plant this week is a cactus, and it's the Gymnocalycium. Shane, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Brian.
I've been listening to Shane Taylor. He's the horticultural specialist and buyer for cactus and tropicals in Salt Lake City. This is the Zesty Garden, and we're moving to our section now. We're going to talk about insects, and I have Diane Alston in studio with me today. And if you'd like to call in with a question or comment, the toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 1-800-826-1495. You can also send us an email question at zestygarden@gmail.com or post to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page. Diane, thanks for coming in.
Ah, thanks, Brian, for inviting me.
Okay, now, you did a very good thing, or it could also be looked at as a very bad thing for me, because now every day in my inbox, I get an email that tells me about some insect research that's going on, and invariably it's fascinating, and then I click on it and I read the whole article.
Yeah, it's this website called Entomology Today, and it's pretty cool because it's supported by the Entomological Society of America, and they have a dedicated staff person that's basically browsing the cool entomology literature that's out there, and then making some very public oriented, you know, so more of a layman's, but also just, you know, picking topics that would be of interest to the general public and condensing them down and adding some cool pictures. Sometimes there's video clips and things. And so now you're addicted.
I'm addicted. This is really good. I highly recommend it. And you just go to Entomology Today, and it's right there on the front page. And then there's a link to sign up to get these yourself. So
yeah, so I think it would be great for like school teachers, scout troops, any kind of, you know, group that would have some kind of education orientation where you want to, you know, pick some kind of cool topics that could get kids or not even kids, adults too, but interested in science and motivated to think about all the cool things that happen in our natural world.
So when something like this pops up. The title is Zombie Ladybugs Protect Their Own Predators. I mean, that just sucked me right in.
Yeah.
Because I like lady beetles, and I felt bad for the lady beetle that's protecting this predator, its own predator.
Yes.
It's a great picture. So why don't we start out with that one?
Yeah. So this is a story, I guess you'd call it, but it's a real event. It's a factual thing. And it's very, this kind of activity is actually pretty common in the insect world. And I bet there's examples from other taxa of animals out there too. But being an entomologist, that's what I know the most about are the insect. But there's quite a few examples in the insect world where one insect can basically kind of control the mind of another. And in this case, this seven-spot lady beetle is the host, which means that there's this other insect that attacks it, and it's a little wasp. And the female wasp will lay her egg inside of its lady beetle host. And then that little egg hatches and grows up inside, and it gradually feeds on the ladybug, eating different parts of the tissue, but doing so very carefully so that it doesn't want to kill its host. Because you can imagine if you're still not fully grown yourself and you kill your food source, well, that's not very smart, is it? So it's a very slow process. So it takes about 3 weeks in the insect's life. That's pretty slow. And then at the end, it's ready to emerge and go through. The wasp has to go through this required resting stage where it's going to change from this little larva looking thing, grub looking thing to an adult wasp. And so it has to make a little pupa or cocoon stage. And it does that outside the lady beetle's body. And so in the process, it emerges, but does so very carefully so as not to damage its host too much. It's just a small little wound, so to speak. And by this point, the lady beetle's not doing too good because it's had much of its insides eaten out, but it has had its mind altered in this process. So its behavior is now different. Instead of what you might think, I don't know, what would an insect do if it's being devoured from the inside out? What are the options it might do? But what it does is it basically becomes this passive little shell, and it holds the cocoon of the parasitic wasp kind of in its arms, so to speak, in its legs. And it protects it because at this stage, the wasp is very vulnerable to other things that might want to come along and eat it. I guess lacewing larvae are one of its common predators in the natural world.
What about lady beetle larvae?
And lady beetle larvae, right.
Okay.
Exactly. And so, but it's not just a passive little bodyguard or shell. It actually is still alive. And if there is an approach of a predator, this lady bug zombie will actually move its legs. And that deters the predator from coming close and bothering it and bothering the wasp. And so it acts as this zombie bodyguard for a period of several days. It'll depend on how warm it is, how quickly the wasp completes its development. And then once the wasp is done with it, it leaves and it goes off and the lady beetle will die. So it enslaves its lady beetle host in the process.
So let's back up and look at insect physiology, because and we talked about this last year sometime, but insects inside they don't operate the same as we would think of humans. The circulatory system is completely
It's called
different.
An open circulatory system, so it's not like through vessels like we have.
And so help me understand how a pest like this, the parasitoid, I could just imagine him chewing through things. Mm-hmm. Is he just drinking up some of this fluid a little bit at a time?
Yeah. Before I answer that, I want to back up to something you just said I thought was very interesting. So you called this parasitoid wasp a pest. Did you notice that?
I didn't.
But but interestingly, if this was a wasp that was attacking, we're going to talk about another insect in a little bit here, a new invasive beetle that's attacking our ash trees. That wasp you would consider a beneficial, right?
Exactly.
But now because this wasp is attacking a lady beetle, it's a pest. So isn't that? I just wanted to point that out. I'm sorry for that little side.
Is that bad?
No, it's not. But
I think changing my thinking?
I think what it shows us, or it's an example of how humans, we classify things as good or bad, pests are bad. And it has to do with how we view them. So we view a lady beetle as a beneficial insect because it's out there eating aphids and other insects that we find as to be pests. But and now this wasp that attacks it is the pest. But if it was attacking one of those pests of ours, we would consider it a beneficial.
I would. And I wish there was a parasitoid of box elder bugs.
Exactly.
Or so earwigs.
You would love that. You would be in love with that particular parasitoid. So I just wanted to, that's a little sidebar, but it's interesting because it's a human nature that we're very much
categorize.
We
things.
Are very much categorizers, and so yes. But from the wasp perspective, it's just doing what it knows how to do. So that was interesting. But yeah, you made a very good point. So back to your question or your comment was about, so when this little wasp is inside the lady beetle feeding away, again being very selective about what it consumes first because it doesn't want to kill the ladybug right off the bat. It does have some effect then on that physiology of the lady beetle because it's eating, it's changing the chemistry of what we call insect blood. The term entomologists use is called hemolymph, and it's making some changes there. And that hemolymph is floating around, and it's impacting the brain. It's impacting the glands that work in conjunction with the brain. And so that's how these behaviors can be changed. So this lady beetle now is no longer a typical lady beetle going out seeking. It does still continue to eat, say, aphids for a period of time, because if it didn't, it wouldn't survive. But it's not going to be laying eggs. It's not going to be mating. It's not going to fulfill all those other kind of normal, behaviors that the adult lady beetle would be doing.
So is it likely then that those chemical changes that are happening inside are what end up changing the brain of the lady beetle just a little bit.
Right. Exactly.
To cause it to do.
So a lot of things are very much chemically based. So there's different hormones and chemicals that move around in the hemolymph of the insect, just as we have hormones in our own blood. And if so, if there's changes in that, that can then alter the behavior of, in this case, the lady beetle. And so it's a very interesting phenomenon. It's pointed out that it's, you know, it's obviously a genetically controlled trait. This wasp has the ability to do this, and it affects the lady beetle in a certain way. It's a, you know, big part of natural selection that this these kinds of traits have evolved to be very the host specific. They pick certain hosts that this relationship works out very well in. And so it's just really a cool part of our overall kind of insect ecology. But I mentioned as we started talking about this that this is not an unusual phenomenon. We've talked on this show a number of times about this protozoan, this natural product you can buy called nolobate. It's a protozoan that attacks grasshoppers called Nosema lacusta. And it not the same kind of behavior changing, but it causes a behavior change in grasshoppers when they consume it. In this case, it's a protozoan. It's just this little, very simple organism, a spore, and it, you know, develops into a protozoan organism. And what that behavior change from the grasshoppers is after they've consumed it and that protozoan starting to attack the tissues of its body, the grasshopper has this urge, so to speak, to climb high. And so it'll climb up on the stalk of the plant where it's been feeding, and then it will die at some point. And then the integument, the exoskeleton of the grasshopper, will break open at some point, and this protozoan is now multiplied many, many times. And there's, you know, thousands of these, maybe even a million of these little spores, and they're going to spew out of this grasshopper and rain down on the plants around it. And that's a great advantage for the protozoan now, because now it's spread out, it's dispersed. More grasshoppers are going to come along and eat more spores. And you know, this effect is going to proliferate. And so that's, again, a behavior-altering effect. And this is from a protozoan. It's not even like a, you know, like an insect, something as, you know, as complex as a whole insect.
Seems like on nature, I can't remember what the program was, but I seem to remember a wasp doing the same thing with a spider.
Mm-hmm. Right,
Same. So are a lot of these are wasps?
In the case of this lady beetle attacker, yes, it is a wasp, and so they are the groups of wasps that are common parasitoids or parasites of other insects. They are the ones that have obviously developed some of these very highly evolved abilities to attack their hosts and to change the host's behavior. So there's many examples of that. The one you may be thinking of is these spider attacking wasps, where they'll actually paralyze their wasp. I mean, excuse me, the wasp will paralyze its spider prey. It's still alive. It's just like kind of like in suspended animation, and it will drag the spider into a hole in the ground, the wasp will lay its eggs on the spider, and the spider stays in that kind of suspended state for a period of time while the wasp larvae hatch and feed on it. And it, at some point, of course, the spider dies, but it does play a role in helping support the offspring for a period of time.
Well, and I've seen this parasitizing behavior in monarch caterpillars, because I usually collect them each year. Mm-hmm. We like to have them in our home and have them get into their chrysalis and so forth. But some of them just don't quite make it. Mm-hmm. And if we leave them long enough, all of a sudden we see something emerging from mm-hmm. the leftover caterpillar because it has been consumed.
Right. You weren't aware that it was parasitized a lot early on. Later on, you might notice, well, it's not acting the same, it's not eating as much, you know, it's
looking a little sick.
It's looking a little sick. Yeah. Color, it might darken in color often. That's a common characteristic that happens. So, yeah, so you've observed that firsthand.
So, most of these are very host specific.
They are. They are. And you can imagine that's kind of necessary for this to work, because if you've evolved as an organism, a wasp, to be able to feed in a certain way and ultimately change the behavior of your host, that might be different in a different host. You know, their chemistry is a little different, their physiology is a little different. And so you can imagine that it's a very close-knit relationship. And so oftentimes these are very specialized parasitoids, or you know, natural enemies.
So here I am compartmentalizing again. Men have these little boxes in their brains, and so I pulled one out and put the other one back in. So I keep thinking of how they would have evolved together. I mean, which wasp was the first one who thought, okay, I'll lay an egg in this lady beetle and see what happens?
Yeah.
I mean, if it's not successful, then that wasp possibly may die unless it's trying all these different hosts. How does this begin in the first place?
Well, and I'm not an evolutionary entomologist, but certainly I try to pay attention to these things. So I know a little bit, enough to get myself in trouble. So, I hope I won't get myself in too deep of trouble. But in general, I mean, we don't know all, you know, the whole evolution and how these things evolved millions of years ago. But we do have some ideas based on phylogenetics, so, you know, relationships and relatedness, genetic relationships. And it does look like probably, because insects really took off in their expansion of the planet Earth when plants took off. So they were, you know, fairly early terrestrial animals on this planet. And when plants really took off and diversified, angiosperms and so forth, insects followed and played many different roles. Pollinators, you know, plant feeders, you know, and then became food for other insects. So we believe that actually a lot of these, you know, parasitic types of relationships may have evolved as kind of plant-based systems first, where an organism was consuming a plant, but then it ingested something on that plant that then, you know, was able to attack it and become like a parasite. So, you know, again, that's a simplification. And like I said, I can get myself in trouble with the evolutionary entomologist, but it's, you know, that's kind of how it started.
So are there examples of insects that, like the lady beetle, for instance, is it possible that as evolution continues to happen with it, that it will find a defense mechanism?
Yes. In fact, there's examples of that. I don't know about in this particular lady beetle, but there are examples in the insect world. For example, one of them is gypsy moth. We have in the eastern part of North America, there's a native species of gypsy moth. There's now since been an invasive species too. But the gypsy moths that feed in the hardwood forest back there, they tend to go through these big cycles in population growth. So when their outbreak numbers, lots of them, you know, defoliating the trees, we call that like an epidemic cycle. And at that time, they're very prone to get infected with a virus that's also a naturally occurring virus. And it tends to have its most impact when the populations of gypsy moth caterpillars are big. It makes sense. Lots of caterpillars, lots of virus attack. But what the gypsy moth caterpillar, some of them have evolved, is ability to wall off. So this virus particle gets in. I don't know if they're typically probably ingested. And it's inside the body of the caterpillar and ready to start, you know, causing it to get ill and replicating and so forth. But the caterpillar in its you know, physiology does not get thinks about this, but it inside this innately happens. It detects this as a foreign object, a foreign thing. And it starts to build this cells divide in the area where the virus particle is, and it walls off that virus. So the virus is still there, but it can't do what it wants to do, that is replicate and spread and get to different parts of the insect body, because the caterpillar is now walled it off. And the caterpillar can go on and have a completely normal life, complete its development, go on and be an adult gypsy moth and so forth. So there are, and that's just one example, there's many of those.
And so, but the opposite could also be true. Now, the moth has figured out a way to wall it off, but now it might figure out a way to to get out of that breakout
right.
of the wall.
Right. So. Oh, it's an arms race for sure. Yeah. I mean, it's a back and forth. You know, one of the organisms figuring out a new little trick, so to speak, to get around the obstacles of the other, and then the other one coming back. And this is very common with plants. And so that's why, again, kind of referring back to my earlier comment, that entomologists tend to think that a lot of these relationships actually started between like plants and insects, and then they moved on into other, higher, we call them trophic levels. So now you've got insects eating insects or, you know, parasitizing insects, and sometimes there could be secondary parasites and even tertiary. So all these different trophic levels, a lot of those kind of started with that more plant-based system. And there certainly have lots of examples of arms races between plants, plant chemistry, so the different kinds of chemicals that plants produce to protect themselves. That's an arms race with insects that want to eat them. So if they now produce this pretty nasty chemical that deters certain insects, then they're free of those insects, so to speak. But then yet there's another insect out there that evolves to be able to overcome those particular chemicals and can still feed on the plant. So that's a constant process.
It's a fascinating process. Yeah. And it's actually a really beautiful process when you think about how nature has developed that. I'm thinking of a snake in California and I think it's a newt that
has a trototoxin.
Yes. They're actually seeing it change just within like a one or two generations.
Right. There's certain populations of garter snakes now that, again, this is a research of one of my fellow colleagues, Butch Brody, in the Department of Biology. So again, if I misspeak, I hope I don't go too far awry, that there's now these populations of garter snakes in certain areas that have developed, like you say, very quickly in just several, few generations, which is, that's quick in evolutionary time, to withstand much higher doses, concentrations of these tetrodotoxins that these newts are producing.
Well, we're going to continue our conversation. We're going to take a quick break and then be back. Diane Alston is Utah State University's extension entomologist, and we're talking insects, and you can join our conversation. It's a live conversation. Toll free, it's 1-800-826-1495. That's 826-1495. You can send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com or post to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page. We'll be right back. Hello and welcome back to the second part of The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in studio with me today is Diane Alston. She's USU's extension entomologist, and of course, we're talking about insects and insect research, but you may have your own question or comment that you need answered. Toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495, or send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. Okay, so here's another article from Entomology Today, and we're talking about these because we have a new module coming together, and we're calling it Bug Bites, BYTES, because there'll be small vignettes, and as different topics come up, we can record them and play them back later, so we don't have to overwhelm you with all of them at once. But the next one I wanted to look at was the emerald ash borer, which we have mentioned on the program, and how it's becoming a major pest of ashes. But now it has spread to a different tree that you said is in the olive family,
right? So ash is in the olive family, and so is this new host. They think it's a new host. That they've now found it in Ohio in particular. I don't know if it's more widespread than that, but this is what's called the white fringe tree. And like ash, the white fringe tree is native to the northern Midwestern parts of the country. But it's also become a very popular tree to plant in landscapes. And actually, I know that it's been promoted here in Utah as a suitable landscape tree because it doesn't tend to have many pests. But obviously now that maybe this new information is unfolding with emerald ash borer, which we don't yet have in Utah, but we're thinking it's only a matter of time before we probably will, just because it is now on our doorstep. It's just across the Rocky Mountains in Boulder, Colorado, and has become quite widespread in that area, in that county. So it's
cold doesn't stop it.
No. It's it was first found in the United States. So let's back up a little bit. Emerald ash borer is this actually quite a pretty iridescent green. There's a little bit of blue in it. Beetle. It's called a flat-headed boar because the body tends to be flattened dorsoventrally. But also it is in a group called metallic wood-boring beetles. And we do have native species of metallic wood-boring beetles here. You might be familiar with the one that gets in our raspberries and also gets in roses called the rose stem girdler as an example. Also one that you have seen kind of ravage our birch trees here, our weeping birch trees here, is the bronze birch borer.
And these are all flathead?
These are all flat-headed borers. So they're all in the same group as the emerald ash borer. But emerald ash borer is not native here. It's native to Asia, northern Asia in particular. So it's not. It's very cold tolerant. It's not affected by cold. And the first time it was found in the United States was in the Detroit area I think it was 2002. And so, and it's, since then it's spread and it's become a very economically damaging tree borer. It's now estimated to have killed tens of millions of ash trees. And I thought it was interesting. I was reading a little bit more background, and there's an estimate. There's in the North America, there's about about 8.7 billion ash trees. And this beetle, this one species of beetle, has now killed tens of millions of ash trees. And so in places like Michigan, the upper Northwest, it's been devastating. And moved into Illinois now, Iowa, all those areas. So it's estimated that in 5 years from now, 2019, that this will cause $10 billion in loss of landscape trees and associated issues, watershed issues, and so forth. So just, you know, a devastating, devastating insect. And as I mentioned, native to China, northern Asia, and now quite widespread in the eastern United States.
Is it likely that there will be other trees in the olive family that will be affected
by
this?
That's a great question. And so
Russian olive, I wouldn't mind so much. But.
Up until this point, I'm not sure if Russian olive is even a true olive, is it?
Okay.
Sometimes the common names are, I'm not sure. We'll have to check on that over the break. But sometimes what they had felt is that, most of the ash, a true ash, now we're not talking about things like mountain ash. That is not a true ash. But, green ash, European ash, I don't know all the different kinds of names of ash, Fraxineus is the genus, I believe, and that those are all in the olive family. And it was believed to this point that this emerald ash borer only attacked trees, ash, that were in this genus, Fraxineus. And so that was kind of where the knowledge has been. And so you would think if in China this white fringe tree was also a host, we would know about it. But unfortunately, a lot of the literature, it is in Chinese. And so we're not as well versed in understanding what is known about this insect. There certainly is ongoing work to try to learn more. But now that it seems it has been confirmed by DNA confirmation that these white fringe trees in Ohio, that this one entomologist suspected might have emerald ash borer, do indeed have been attacked. It's still early days, and they don't know how widespread it is in the white fringe tree. And of course, they'll be looking at whether there could be other olive family, or even whether this beetle might even be able to, break out and move into other families of trees. We just don't know yet.
Is it likely then? I mean, obviously, where it lives in China, there must be some pests.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess there I go again with that word pest. There must be some attacking insects to keep it at bay. Otherwise, they'd lose all their ash trees.
Right. So what we tend to see in a more native environment where you've got an insect that feeds on a plant, a tree in this case, is that, yes, it does, but it's usually not epidemic levels. It stays in balance. It does feed on trees. A lot of times the trees may not die or may not die in a short, it takes an extended amount of time to kill them. The beetle has has natural enemies that help keep it in check, but also it has competition with other borers or organisms that might be inhabiting some of the same niches as it does. And so it keeps more of a balance, and it's there and present, but it's not an outbreak situation. But then when that insect in this case gets moved to a new a new place, a new continent in this case, then it has this niche that's wide open, doesn't have its native natural enemies, and so it can just take off and really overwhelm.
And so locally, locally to the U.S., have they found any natives that might be going after it?
So in terms of natural enemies?
Yeah.
Yeah. So there was another article there on the Entomology Today website that we were looking at.
So and somebody had asked via email. So the address is entomologytoday.org, and that's entomology, entomologytoday.org.
Okay. Yeah. So there's a fairly new article up on that Entomology Today website about another group of researchers. Forget where they are. Kentucky. That's right. They're working in Kentucky, where now this emerald ash borer is devastating the ash trees there, and they've been looking at a wasp parasitoid. So now we're considering a beneficial, not a pest, because it's not attacking the lady beetle. And they've brought this in from its native range in northern Asia. And they're having some pretty good success with getting it established and having it start to attack the emerald ash borer that are in North America and in Kentucky in particular. And one of the ways that they're doing that is that they're actually suppressing the emerald ash borer population slightly by using some systemic insecticides that don't, unfortunately, kill the emerald ash borer very well, but they do slow it down. And so by doing that, making its development last longer, population growth not expanding as rapidly, and then releasing these wasps that they've brought in from Asia, they've been able to get some successful establishment and kill of the emerald ash borer. So this approach we call classical biological control, where you go to the country of, when you have a non-native pest and you go to the country of origin and you find a natural enemy that's there in that environment and bring it back and establish it and get it to work here. But in addition, the same group of researchers in Kentucky is now also interestingly finding some native species of parasitic wasp that they're now finding attacking emerald ash borer. So that's particularly exciting because there are certainly concerns about bringing in a non-native insect, even if it's what we consider a beneficial. Can you think about some concerns you might have if someone told you they were bringing in a parasitic wasp that to your area that wasn't there before, besides just that it might help suppress the target pest? But what other concerns do you think you might have?
Well, for me, I'd be thinking, okay, if I were this insect, I'd think, okay, there are these, but oh, I just found this other tree I want to attack, and then I become a pest,
right,
as it were, rather than
right,
a beneficial.
Right, or this beneficial could attack some of our native insects that mm-hmm. we don't want to have attacked, including some native lady beetles, for example, things like that. So there are concerns with bringing in any kind of non-native organism, whether it be what we might consider a beneficial even as compared to a pest.
So I'm guessing they do a ton of research to see exactly.
They do.
What is this? I'm thinking of the tamarisk beetle.
Right.
I think it is that they found that attacks the tamarisk mm-hmm. and nothing else.
Right.
Absolutely nothing else.
Right. And so there is, as you mentioned, there is a very strict set and very intensive, comprehensive set of tests that any introduced organism, whether it's an insect or fungus or anything, has to go through to ensure that it will be very specific to the target, whether it's being a beneficial insect targeting an insect pest or a fungus targeting a plant or whatever it might be, or a tamarisk beetle targeting a weed. And then also another component of that is a lot of times they can bring in secondary things. So maybe they've got a fungus that's actually in them that we didn't realize, or maybe they have another parasite that's actually attacking them. And so you can bring in these other basically carpetbagger kinds of organisms at the same time. So you have to be very careful to clean them up, to screen them carefully. So all this is done in sanitary conditions first in, you know, white labs where, you know, nothing's allowed to escape. Everything's very contained. And then eventually it'll be to the greenhouse level again, a lot of, you know, biosecurity in those greenhouses and before they're finally released. So it's not like a simple process. You travel to another country, bring back a parasitic wasp you found attacking emerald ash borer there, and then release it in the United States.
Well,
it takes years.
In olden days, I'm thinking Africanized honeybees. I mean, they were doing research on them in South America, and some escaped. And
wow, you can see what kinds of consequences there can be. So if there's any opportunity to use what we call natural biological control, so the other kind versus the classical, we always prefer that first because. Mm-hmm. Because we don't have to go through that whole process and worry about non-target effects. And so since they are now, this group in Kentucky is now finding several species of wasps that are now attacking the emerald ash borer, that's particularly exciting. And that's just brand new news hot off the press. I hadn't heard that before I read this article. Mm.
Okay, so I need to know, how does a wasp landing on the bark of an ash tree detect a larva inside the tree?
That's a great question. And so there can be multiple ways, but one of the primary ways for any of these wasps that lay their eggs in or on wood-boring insects is by sound. And so each chewing insect, larva or adult, usually it attacks the larval stage, has a characteristic chewing, you know, pattern and sound as it chews, and where it's chewing in the wood, you know, whether it's closer to the surface or deeper in the surface, you know, the wasp is going to know what to look for, or to listen for its vibrations. So they land on it. They by the vibrations that they sense through all the little hairs that are on their feet that allow them to detect that. There could also be some chemical cues too, because insects are very big into chemical cues, and so it could be if there are any holes, you know, bore holes and openings where some of the chemicals that are being released from the chewing on the wood or pheromones associated with the insect that wasps could also pick up on.
It's just, again, I said this before, but it's just fascinating to me, because I think of me landing on a tree and trying to detect a little larva down there. Well, that's never going to work, but they're just very specialized.
Very, very specialized. And insect, we're learning more and more about insect sound all the time, that it's actually playing a more important role than we ever realized, because we don't detect those small vibrations, but insects do.
Diane, thank you very much.
Yeah, it's been fun. Thanks, Brian.
You've been listening to Access Utah. Diane Alston is USU's extension entomologist. And if you want more information about how to sign up, just go to entomologytoday.org to get these little vignettes that come through about once every day or two.
And then you can be addicted too.
Stay tuned. Coming up next is Petals and Prose.
This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose, and I would like one more time to talk about Victory Gardens and the constraints that people willingly submitted to in the interest of helping with the war cause. And this is, again, from Ursula Buchan's Green and Pleasant Land. And she says, in the late 1930s, market gardening in Britain was not in very good shape, thanks to the ease with which cheaper, hardy vegetables could be imported from Northern Europe, and tender vegetables and fruit from colonial dependencies or dominions, Canada, South Africa, Australia, and New Zealand. The value of imports of fresh fruit and vegetables was very substantial. 33.8 million pounds in 1939, for example, and nearly 250 tons of onions were imported that year, mainly from Holland and Belgium. And 80% of the country's fruit came from infrastructure or mechanization in the years before the war. So the processes were labor-intensive. In that regard, commercial horticulture was similar to agriculture. Well, because Great Britain was importing a lot of their produce when the war started, and German submarines started bombing the ships that were bringing produce, the people in England were in very desperate straits. They actually could not get the foods, the vegetables and fruits they had been used to having available. There wasn't a lot of gardening taking place in England then. Wealthy people had gardeners and had formal gardens and mainly a lot of flowers, sometimes a vegetable garden. But Great Britain really was meeting malnutrition in the face. I've been reading a book by Hilary Mantel on Margaret Thatcher, and she wasn't well liked by everyone, even though she served four terms as prime minister. But she was called by some Maggie Thatcher milk snatcher because she withdrew free milk from the school lunch program. So she was very despised for this, taking away the nourishment of children in the nation. A lot of the communication that went to the people was by radio. There weren't many television sets at all, and they were very expensive. But radios were almost ubiquitous. Almost everyone had a radio. However, in March 1924, less than 2 years after the British Broadcasting Company was founded, the first practical gardening bulletins were broadcast on the radio. These were provided to the BBC by the Royal Horticultural Society and mostly written by Frederick Chittenden, director of Wisley Gardens. At the end of 1924, the RHS, that's the Royal Horticultural Society, also supplied a separate bulletin for the north of England. From time to time, well-known gardeners such as Vida Sackville-West, you may remember my having talked about her, provided more elevated contributions. In 1931, the BBC asked the Society to recommend gardeners who might be approached as speakers. One of the names, among them was Vida Sackville-West, was that of C.H. Middleton. Mr. Middleton's first broadcast on the 9th of May, 1931, began, "Good afternoon. Well, it's not much of a day for gardening, is it?" It was immediately obvious that he had what it took to shine in the new medium. However, for the first 3 years, he was just one of several broadcasters under RHS direction. It was not until September 1934 that he was given his own weekly series, In the Garden, which soon changed into In Your Garden. The programming was a great success, and as we shall see, the obvious vehicle for publicizing a wartime gardening campaign. And he continued broadcasting regularly until his untimely death in 1945. The wireless was well set up before 1939 to be the medium for mass communications to the British people during the war. I thought that was interesting in the light of the very program I'm speaking on. The people were war-weary, and they took to the idea of gardens with quite goodwill. As far as the government was concerned, the BBC's most important wartime function was the swift dissemination of official information to the general public. War would disrupt virtually every aspect of normal life. The general public would need to be advised on how to cope. More than this, they had to be encouraged to identify their day-to-day hardships with the wider endeavor. Radio's immediacy, its directness, its sheer ubiquity marked it out for this task. From 1938 onwards, as war looked increasingly likely, there had been a public debate on the morality of rationing food. Many politicians, especially on the left, maintained in the last 6 months of the First World War, there had been some dissenting voices. According to the Daily Express, the public should revolt against the food rationing system, that dreadful and terrible iniquity. There is no necessity for the trouble and expense of rationing. Nevertheless, by the time wartime broke out, the population in general seemed to have accepted that rationing was inevitable, and they were grimly resigned. Indeed, in November, a British Institute of Public Opinion poll found that 60% of those questioned thought rationing necessary. Some shopkeepers had already started to conduct their own rationing, keeping back basic supplies for their regular customers. Forthcoming rationing was announced on November 1st, 1939, and came into force on the 8th of January, 1940. Each household had to register with a supplier for rationed items, which initially consisted of bacon, butter, and cheese, but later sugar, tea, eggs, meat, and sweets. Vegetarians were issued with a special ration book, which entitled them to more cheese and eggs as substitutes for meat. Unlike other items, meat was rationed by price rather than by weight. From September 23, 1939, petrol, or gasoline, for the 10% of the population who owned a car was severely rationed to 7 gallons a month. Can you imagine that? 7 gallons of gas a month, allowing for journeys of no more than 200 miles. My own father happened to be a traveling salesman, and he had to plead for a special dispensation to get more gasoline because it meant his livelihood. But that soon ended when he was drafted and was with the occupation troops in Japan just after the war ended. Well, there is so much that is fascinating to me about this subject, and some of you are so young, you wouldn't relate to it. But I'm old enough, one of the few advantages of growing old, that I can remember, and I do know that it was a difficulty. But even though some people grumbled, I think that most people either had husbands or sons or friends fighting, or their own soil, in the case of England, was being bombed. I talked with my good friend Sandra Berry in Nova Scotia, and she could remember rationing and even went so far as to check the library to find pictures and posters to urge people to follow rationing and to grow victory gardens. So this is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose. Thank you.
The Zesty Garden is a production of Utah Public Radio with producer Shalane Smith-Needham and Brian Earle. To listen to past programs or get additional information about the show, just go to upr.org. If you have an idea for an interview, including guests or topics, send your suggestions to zestygarden@gmail.com. You're listening to Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 Logan, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUST HD1 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.